This is the Thrive Podcast, the podcast that allows you to, well, thrive. So welcome to another edition of the Thrive Podcast. And with us today, I actually am very excited to be welcoming this guest because he's just got so many interesting subjects he can talk about, which is extremely inspiring. It will be extremely helpful to every one of you, I can assure you. He is known as a kindness scientist. How about that? Speaker, columnist, he's a doctor. And he's got a PhD. Let me introduce him without further ado. It's Dr. David Hamilton. Welcome, David.
Oh, thank you very much. It's my absolute pleasure to be here and to chat to you both tonight. I'm so excited to be on your podcast. I mean, thank you for inviting me.
Very happy to have you. And I know Alan is sort of chomping at the bit to get cracking. So I'll hand the reins over to him.
No, absolutely. I am. And so, David, our podcast is really about mental well-being and high performance. But I know that you often speak about the connection between mental and physical health. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, well, oftentimes what I talk about is, you know, how really the connection between your mind and your body. I mean, for example, in many ways, your brain doesn't make a distinction between sometimes between what is real and what's imaginary. For example, if you visualize, you imagine doing something repetitively, then to your brain, that's really happening. In fact, if you look at brain scans sometimes of a person doing a thing, a physical movement repetitively, and a person imagining doing the thing repetitively, and you put the scan side by side, it's often difficult to tell the difference between who was actually doing the thing and who was imagining doing the thing. And what that immediately tells us is what we're doing with our minds has a physical effect on the brain. But then because, you know, the mind, the brain, and the body are connected, what you then see is the region of the brain that's now just changed as a consequence of whether you're doing something physically or in your imagination, that impacts that part of the body as well. I mean, for example, if you're imagining moving a muscle, then not only does that part of the brain corresponding to that muscle change, but so also does the strength or range or flexibility of the muscle that you're actually imagining moving, to an extent almost as if you were doing the thing yourself, even though you were doing it in your imagination. So what this sort of research tells us is there's a very, very strong and clear link between, you know, your mind and your body. And if you work sometimes on your mental health and you can feel better in yourself, then that can also have a very powerful effect, because what happens immediately is you begin to have a calming effect on your nervous system. And when your nervous system is more calm, I suppose you're able to make, you feel better, but you're able to make clearer decisions and more, I guess, more inspired decisions as well. So there's a multifaceted link between the mind and the body.
It's a fascinating subject. But in terms of athletes, our audience,
yeah,
how can this impact them? We know the power of the mind in terms of their performance, but of course, this is all about not only performance, it's about wellness. How can using these theories, and perhaps you've got some ideas and examples of techniques and in interventions of how they can practice using this study for their benefit?
In terms of the physical performance or their mental health?
I think both, really.
Both, right. Oh, well, in terms of physical performance, let me give you an example, actually. So one of my favorite studies in this phenomena was done at Harvard University, led by a neurologist called Alvaro Pascal León. And he got a group of volunteers to play a sequence of piano notes with their fingers, up and down a sequence, like plunk, 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 up and down a scale, five notes for 2 hours on five consecutive days. And, you know, it wasn't 2 hours straight. That's tiring. So you do like a minute of plunking, a minute rest, a minute but for a two-hour period, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Now, they had their brain scanned on each day, and the region of the they focused on the region of the brain connected to the finger muscles. Now, that region of the brain had significantly grown in size, and it's a phenomena, a well-known phenomena called neuroplasticity. It's like the brain isn't as fixed and hardwired as most people would ordinarily think. In fact, it's very moldable, flexible, and changeable, and it's always changing in response to what you learn, what you experience in your life, and also how you think and feel. But while each person was playing the notes physically, a second group of people played the notes in their mind. So they were asked to do what's called kinesthetic imagery, and that means to place their hands flat as if they were on a piano, but just on a flat piece of table, close their eyes, and imagine what it would be like. And that's what kinesthetic imagery means. You imagine as if you were playing the notes, what these feelings and sensations would be like, what that would feel like, as if you really were striking those notes. And they also did it for the 2 hours in their imagination, the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And when you looked at the brain scan side by side on the Friday, you couldn't tell the difference between who played the notes with their fingers and who played the notes with their minds. And for all intents and purposes, in some ways, when it comes to movement, the brain doesn't really distinguish all that much between real and imaginary. In fact, if you want, I can show you those brain scans if you think it would be quite interesting. I have them on my phone, the actual brain scans from that study. Just bear with me a second and I'll pull them off. I have them on my... Here we go. So here, what you see, that top row, that fingerprint that's increasing in size, that's the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. That's the region of the brain connected to the finger muscles. Now, the top two rows are the people who are playing the notes with their fingers. The middle two rows are the people that's playing the notes with their mind versus a control group at the bottom. So as you can see, the brain isn't distinguishing between who played the notes for 2 hours a day with their fingers or who played the notes for 2 hours a day with their minds when it comes down to physical movement. In many ways, the brain doesn't distinguish all that much. Now, scientists at the Lerner Research Institute in Cleveland took that a little bit further and said, okay, well, what about the people who were imagining playing the notes? Well, their fingers get stronger because the people playing the notes with their fingers, surely their muscles will get stronger. So what about the people imagining? So they set up an experiment and they asked volunteers for 15 minutes a day, 5 days a week for 3 months, to do that, an extension and contraction of the little finger, right? Just that was all. Just, you know, they basically do it for like, you know, 15 seconds, 20 seconds rest, but just extending and contracting the fingers on and off for 15 minutes. And they did it 5 days a week for 3 months, had their strength tested by lifting a wee set of weights on the first day and at the end of the 3 months. Now, they'd grown in strength by 53%. Now, that's, you would expect something like that for doing that extension. Now, the other group, instead of doing that with the fingers, again, kinesthetic imagery, they placed their hands flat and imagined what that would be like, what it would feel like as if they really were doing that, but hand flat, just imagining the physical sensations. Again, for that 15 minutes for the 3 months. And amazingly, they'd improved in strength by 35%. And they hadn't even lifted a finger. Crap joke, I know. Hadn't lifted a finger. But isn't that amazing? You know, yeah, it wasn't 53% like the people doing the extension and contraction, but it also wasn't zero. So what you'd seen here is people had actually improved their physical strength by using their mind, by using their imagination. And the reason it works, and this is what this research at Harvard and the Lerner Research Institute and other institutes show, is the repetition of imagining something causes a physical change in the fine structure of the brain, in the region of the brain that's associated with what you're imagining moving. And because that's also connected to the body, what you get is a corresponding change in whether it's strength, range, flexibility, or function of that particular part of the body. In fact, I wrote a blog today, and I was writing a blog because someone had asked me a question about because I play tennis. I live in Dunblane. With Andy Murray and Jamie Murray kind of grew up. And one of my friends keeps getting these injuries. And he said, you know, can I use visualization? And I said, absolutely, when you're injured, because visualization can actually offset the rate of muscle strength decline. And scientists did that study just a couple of years ago. they got volunteers to put themselves in a cast, a full cast from the elbow right up to the fingers, that it completely immobilized the wrist. And then they were asked them every day, half of them every day, to imagine that they were pushing their hand, their wrist against the cast and trying to bend, trying to do that movement in their imagination. And they did that just for about a quarter of an hour every day for 4 weeks while they were immobilized in the cast. Now, the control group, the comparison group, they had lost 45% of physical strength in that 4 weeks. But those who did the visualization, they'd lost half that. I mean, their rate of loss of muscle was half, 50% of that. They'd lost only 24% of their muscle strength by simply using visualization. And what that type of study shows is how we can actually use our imaginations to offset, if you will, some of the loss in strength or performance that might occur if someone is actually suffering an injury. I think that kind of stuff's amazing, you know.
But it is interesting. Sorry, Alan, if I could just continue. I just was curious to know how we can use that stuff, how long it takes to work using these kind of techniques, if you like, to improve one's mental health, wellness, and even performance.
You know, astonishingly fast, actually. You know, the brain changes really, really quickly. Many people who use visualization notice changes, albeit sometimes small changes initially, within a day or two. Where changes get better is they accumulate over time. So it's the repetition that matters, even more than how long you do a particular exercise for. It's the frequency, it's the repetition of it, more than how long you do it for. But if it's repetitive, that's how the brain begins to change. And the more repetitions you do, spaced out in between rest periods, that's how that the brain literally changes astonishingly quickly, and usually within a couple of days. And when it comes to mental health, you know, just, you know, this is a slightly different subject, but one of the things I write about and speak about a lot is the link between kindness and mental health. And what research shows is if you be kind, because of how that feels, that actually causes an improvement in people's happiness long term. The more you do it, the more effect, the stronger the effect. And the more that even has long term protective effects for our mental health. But what's really interesting is scientists have asked people to do a kindness or a compassion based meditation practice. And that's when, as woo woo as this might sound, that's when, you know, classic mindfulness is when you become mindful of the fact that you're breathing. You know, so if I was to breathe, which everyone does every day, but and nothing really happens, nothing much fancy happens to the brain. But the moment I notice that I'm breathing, I'm now mindful of the fact that I'm breathing. My attention is on the fact that I'm breathing. That now brings activity predominantly to this frontal part of the brain. And it undergoes change like a muscle. And it's like if you work out a muscle at the gym, it becomes firmer and larger. So something akin happens in the brain when you do this. And it's, I mentioned the word earlier, and it's called neuroplasticity. But instead of doing mindfulness, and this is where the link with mental health comes in, instead of doing mindfulness, if you switch it to kindfulness, that's the name I give it for, instead of your attention being on the fact that you're breathing, your attention might now be on some kind aspects or thinking kindly about someone, you know, thinking, recalling a time when someone showed you kindness, or recalling some aspects of a person's personality or nature that you feel are particularly warm and kind. And what research shows is that also works out this part of the brain, but there's a slight bias to the left-hand side and a little bit further in as well. And these regions actually undergo physical change. And they're undergoing physical change. They're growing like a muscle. And particularly, these regions are associated with the experience of happiness, positive mood, and, you know, longer-term positive mood effects. And what that really means is, you know, if you worked out a muscle and the muscle became stronger, then it becomes easier to do everything that you use that muscle for. So similarly, if you cause these physical changes in particular brain regions, it becomes easier to do or access the things that these brain regions do. So when you do focus on kindness, for example, then these brain regions affected become essentially more powerful, and it just becomes easier to extract from the backdrop of events and circumstances of our lives, it becomes easier to extract things that, that give us joy, things that make us feel more positive or more happy. So I think these kind of things are really fascinating, because it, as well as using your mind to impact the body physically, there are ways of thinking and focusing that can actually have a, an impact on our mental health. And it's just a slight difference. It, it really just comes down to what you're focusing in and which direction.
So that's really fascinating. So one thing that I hear from you is that what we think can really impact our mind in a positive or a negative way. And yeah, you mentioned visualizations, you mentioned mindfulness, you mentioned kindfulness. Are there any specific steps we need to be aware of in order to use these tools in an impactful way, in a way that they literally shape the architecture of our brain?
Yeah. Well, if you were doing like a mental exercise, a visualization exercise, say to improve performance, the technique is really quite simple. It's, you might do 5 or 10 minutes a day just visualizing. Let's say there was a particular movement that you wanted to enhance. I'll use tennis as an example, because I play tennis myself. I'm not particularly really great. I took up tennis at 46 years old. I'm 51 now, so I've only been playing for 5 years, but I absolutely love it. And so one of the ways that I've used visualization is I would notice that there's a particular type of ball that opponents would send to me. Maybe they would attack my backhand because they think my backhand's a little bit weaker. So what I could do is I could go onto the court and practice that shot. Or I could speed up the learning and speed up the processing of that by mentally rehearsing it. I can visualize dozens and dozens of times, maybe for 5 or 10 minutes a day. I can imagine a ball coming with power and bounce to my backhand. I can imagine myself responding quickly, running back, feeling this in my body. This is what kinesthetic imagery is. And then imagining, reaching down and striking the ball and noticing then the feeling, that way that feels as I do my one-handed backhand. I notice how that feels and imagine the trajectory of the ball. And if I do that dozens and dozens of times, maybe for 5 minutes a day, for example, then that will speed up how quickly I learn that shot dramatically compared to if I just go to the court and try that a few times myself. What you find in many of these types of studies is what you get is physical performance is that good in terms of how fast you learn something, but physical performance combined with visualization is that good in terms of how fast you learn. So it's not so much whether you how high an end you can get to, although it can affect that. But generally what you see is how quickly you get to someplace by tagging visualization onto the physical exercise as well. And so when it comes to actually doing that, it really is quite simple. You literally set aside 5 minutes for an exercise like that. And you say, okay, here is the particular movement I want to do. And then just imagine it as if it's really happening in real time. And then do imagine it 5 times. Take maybe a minute just to relax your mind again. Imagine it 5 times. Take a minute to relax yourself, to relax your mind, just to take a little mental rest. Imagine it 5 times. A minute of a mental rest. Imagine it 5. That sort of thing. So you're doing it in sets of 5, so to speak. But that is the basic technique that's used in most of these scientific studies that demonstrate either a recovery effect and a strength improving effect or a faster learning effect. When it comes to the mental health, when it comes to the mental health stuff in the context of kindness that I was talking about, typically what these studies do is they ask people to do maybe a number of acts of kindness, intentional, over the course of a day, or a week or a month. So let's say it was a day. They might say, I would like to, for this study, to do at least one act of kindness a day for the next week, next 7 days. And then they would compare people's happiness from how they felt at the start to how they feel after the 7 days. Or they compare their happiness to people who are asked for those 7 days just to go about their lives as normal. And what you see in every single kindness study, no matter how long it is, how they do the study, exactly the same result. Kindness makes people happier as a consequence of doing it. And there's a number of reasons why that occurs. But the basic idea behind using a kindness strategy is simply to be kind on purpose. Simply just say, not be kind so that you can gain from it, but be kind because you've decided that this is actually the right thing to do. And by just getting that in my mind, I'm going to be kind here because it's the right thing to do. The side effect, if you will, is that it does actually have an effect on how happy you feel.
Just talking about kindness, David, yeah. I get what you're saying, but can you give me some examples of kindness? Because kindness is very much an umbrella term. I could shake your hand and say, how do you do? And you may think, oh, what a kind gentleman. I could give a homeless man on the street some money. You know, could you give us some precise examples of what kind of kind acts will help our mental health?
Yeah, well, you know, I like the fact you said it's an umbrella term, and that's good because it is actually like an umbrella term, but almost everything in that umbrella, or the vast majority of things in that umbrella, count. And they make a difference because of how they make you feel. You know, for example, you could do the classic thing. I mean, a simple act of kindness would just simply be offering a helping hand to someone. It could be even just listening to someone who needs to talk, even, you know, or just listening to someone's opinion to make them feel validated. Sometimes an act of kindness could be something overtly physical, like I'm going to go out my way to help someone. You know, this person needs a wee bit of work done in their garden and I could probably help them with that, and it'll take me a couple of hours. I'm going to go do that. You know, it's not so much, you don't have to do the big noticeable acts of kindness. You know, the ones that everybody hears about, the big things. I think a lot of us think that for something to qualify as kindness, it has to be big and significant. In actual fact, it's the large number of small everyday things that are most significant. You know, the little paying someone a compliment, the little making someone a cup of tea, the little listening to someone to make them feel validated, the little kind gesture, have a nice day, that you say to the person in the supermarket. It's the everyday, ordinary multitude of small things rather than the big count of things like I made a donation of X, Y, or Z amount of money to such and such a thing, or I did this big noticeable thing. Those count as kindness, but they're few and far between. The things that actually make most of a difference, the things that knit the fabric of society together, are these small things that happen between neighbours, between friends, between family members, between strangers, just the tiny gestures and interactions that have a good intention behind them. Those are the things that I tend to go for more and think of more as acts of kindness.
Interesting. Yeah. But can I just go back, just rewind a little bit before we went on to kindness, and then before I hand over the baton to Alon, who I know has some interesting questions to ask. You, many sports psychologists talk about visualization. But in my studies, I've learned that, of course, we don't even need to study. We have five senses. And I know that from my own personal studies that I have very much a bias auditorily. Can you use your other senses in the same way as visualization in order to help your performance and also to help your mental state, your mental health?
Thanks for that question, Keith. Exactly. And this is why I found myself quite recently using the term when I'm talking about visualization. Either I say imagine or I use the term what it's like for you, because I think so many people I used to always just say visualization, and that can make people assume that you've got to see in high definition, but in actual fact that's not what it's like for someone like you who has an auditory bias, or me. I actually have more of a kinesthetic balance with visual balance. And so you can use any of the senses that are predominant for you. And so when I say, imagine what it's like for you, then use that what it's like for you, meaning how would you imagine something? Would it be a more auditory experience, or would it be a tactile experience that you're visualizing? And it actually doesn't really matter. Visualization by seeing is no better than visualization through tactile or visualization through auditory. It works equally well in either way. It's whatever works for you, whatever is most comfortable for you. You know, so thanks for the question, because it's something that a lot of people, you know, a lot of people don't realize. And I very often forget to make that point as well.
Thanks.
I want to go back to the topic of kindness, because I think it's so relevant to mental well-being. And my first question is, for athletes, it might sound very counterintuitive to be kind, because you live in this competitive environment. You want to be better than your opponents. You want to beat them. How can they be kind in that environment?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that one, Alan. That is counterintuitive. But sometimes if you're thinking unkindly about your opponent, that might work for a lot of people, but for a lot of other people, that actually generates a state of stress. And it stresses your body, your nervous system, and it can also stress the muscles as well. But if you can find a way, let's say call it mental gymnastics, if you can find a way to appreciate, depending on the sport you're playing, to appreciate some aspects, to have respect for your opponent in some ways, then because that in a sense is, it really is partly kindness, having respect for something, then that actually makes you feel better. And that has a more calming effect in your nervous system, because that also has a decluttering effect on your mind. You think more clearly. Lots of research shows when you're feeling in a clearer, more positive mood, you think better, you make better choices, you move better as well. So what I experiment with this myself in my own life, actually, is when you can find a way to be kind to your opponent. And as I say, it doesn't mean like, oh, I'm going to let you win. It's not that. But I can be respectful of you, or I can in my mind silently say good shot or good movement and show some sort of appreciation. And in a sense, even though that might, you might think, well, am I not buoying my opponent up? I'm not necessarily speaking to them, but what I'm actually doing is making myself feel better. So the onus is really on how you feel about what you're doing and with your mindset. And so what you're actually doing is calming your own nervous system, sharpening up your own mind, your own brain. And in a sense, as counterintuitive as it might sound, can actually have a very positive effect, because you're sparing yourself some of the stress that inevitably occurs in particular sporting environments.
One sport, though, comes to mind where perhaps that's the opposite. I'm a big boxing fan. And of course, much of the hype and the promotion around a fight is about trash talking, about speaking badly. And in fact, even in football and tennis, there's a lot of needle, and it tends to motivate. Can you negate that for me?
Yeah, I wonder, and I don't know if this will ever happen, but I have wondered in looking at the trash talking and stuff, and I've wondered if what difference it would make, if it would make a difference. I wondered if what it would be like if boxers instead were complementary of each other's strengths and each other's achievements and stuff like that. I don't know if we'll ever see that. Maybe it has happened in some ways. But I wonder, I don't think the trash talk is necessary. It might be. I don't really know that much about boxing. But, you know, I think being on, maybe it's all in jest. I don't really know. I don't watch it enough for me to be any manner of expert on it. But I've always found that if you can show some respect and appreciation for the better qualities of people, then I think things in the long term in life tend to be better for everybody. Now, maybe in some sports that is absolutely necessary. Maybe it is motivational. Again, I don't know enough about boxing, that particular sport, nor about even the kind of football aspect. But I just wonder if that was to happen and there was openly commentary about the good points and the strengths, and I appreciate that. Because what that actually does is it makes you more insightful yourself. One of the things that science shows is when you look for good things, even in other people, you're more likely to spot them in yourself as well. And you're more likely to get insights, better insights, rather than looking for what's wrong and looking for fault and focusing on fault. If you actually focus on what's better, what's good, then you're more likely to actually get insights that might even help yourself and improve your own performance. And so I wonder if some sports would notice that if they were far more complimentary rather than not. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I just wonder. I have wondered that in the past. But certainly when you're being more appreciative and complimentary, you're more likely to have better insights that could only really enhance your own ability and your own performance.
Great. So I have one follow-up question on that. How do we best express anger then in competitive situations when we're upset with how we're playing, we're upset with an opponent cheating, we're upset with spectators, or we're just upset after losing a match? What's a good way to deal with our anger?
I don't want to give too much away, but I tend to be a very gentle and calm person most of the time. But I found myself occasionally on the tennis court getting a little irritated with dodgy calls, with ball being called out or in or something. What I've noticed is you've just got to deal with it in the moment and put it behind you, whether that means somehow just expressing it through a... The key is to bring a focus. And if it could just be a big... couple of big deep breaths or a shout, whatever people have to do, but just do whatever you have to do that's non-destructive, that's not violent to anyone in the moment, and get it out your system. Because the worst thing you can do is let it get in your head and bug you. Because if you let it get in your head and you keep ruminating about it, then that's only going to affect your performance, because it's going to get you stressed and it's going to make you make errors that you ordinarily wouldn't make. And then when you make the errors, and that causes you even more stress, and then you start doing whatever you're doing dreadfully. So the key is just in the moment, somehow find a way to channel the anger. And it doesn't have, it could be a shout, doesn't have to, if it's tennis, it doesn't have to be, it could be smashing your racket, but you might get a warning for that. Or it could just be a big, outward breath, just a couple, maybe five deep breaths kind of thing, get it out your system. And what that actually does is it brings a lot of the activity and the focus to this frontal part of the brain, which does actually give you a better ability to then think clearly about things. So what I find is helpful then is just doing the, either a shout, or not so much that I do that much, but more I kind of, and just blow air out my mouth. But what that is doing is localizing attention in one part of my brain, that once that's out my system, it does actually help me sharpen my focus in the moment and helps me to put something behind me.
Beautiful. And I can see the benefit of being kind and how it improves our well-being and even our performance. But one thing I see a lot with athletes is that they can actually be very harsh to themselves, very self-critical. And probably within the same logic, it would be so much more helpful for them to be more compassionate and kind towards themselves.
Yeah.
How can we do that? Are there any tips on being kinder to ourselves?
Yeah, that's a huge question. And that's one of the things that most people forget to do and most people know less about doing. And there's a number of little things that we can do. One simple exercise is, many people are familiar with gratitude practices, and a standard gratitude practice that has been shown in the long term to improve people's general happiness and mental well-being is simply to make a list every day of 5 to 10 things that you appreciate. And that might be, I appreciate the sun is shining. It could be something I appreciate. That thing that, you know, X, Y, or Z person said yesterday, I appreciate that I have a house. It could be anything you can think of. But in turning that inwards towards yourself, you could say, okay, 5 of those things, or even if I can only find 1 every day, is going to be something I appreciate about myself. Something I appreciate about who I am, about my skills. Something I appreciate about my personality. Something I appreciate about my mind. Something I appreciate about my body. And it could be just something every day. One thing, if that's all you can think of, or one thing every other day, if you're really struggling, or 2 or 3 things a day. But using part of that gratitude practice, turning in on the focus on yourself. And what that begins to do for us is it begins to make us feel a little bit better about ourselves on the inside. Now, there's a couple of other practices. Another one, now this might sound a wee bit woo-woo to some people, but there's compassion and kindness meditation practices that they're based on a Tibetan Buddhist technique called the loving kindness meditation. And it's called metta. And that begins with, may I be happy and well and safe, and may I feel at ease. And we say that 3 times. May I be happy and well and safe, and may I feel at ease. May I be happy and well and safe, and may I feel at ease. And then the metta practice, we then extend that sentiment of kindness and compassion from ourselves. Now we extend it to loved ones, and you might think of someone in your life, and you think of them and you say in your imagination, may you be happy and well and safe, and may you feel at ease. May you be happy and well and safe, and may you feel at ease. 3 times. And then you might extend it to someone else, and you can even extend it after a little while to people you have issues with, people who annoy you, people you've got challenges with. You think of that person. May you be happy and well and safe, and may you feel at ease. And from time to time, you keep bouncing it back to yourself. Maybe after every second or third person, may I be happy and well and safe, and may I feel at ease. May I be happy and well. And what that type of technique does is it begins to create what's known as self-compassion, which is the opposite from self-criticism. And, you know, so many people I know are Olympic champion self-critics. We're so harsh on ourselves. And we think somehow if I'm critical of myself, it'll make me better. But in actual fact, if we can find compassion for ourselves and know that you're only human, and finding that compassion for yourself, you become more insightful and actually more likely to be able to correct things that you need correcting, rather than just being annoyed or pissed off at something and being critical of it, of yourself all the time. When you place yourself into this more self-compassionate state, because it's a broader, warmer psychological state, you're more likely to get solutions. You're more likely to spot, have an insight. Ah, that's how I change that. I can do that. And you're much more likely to access that state if you practice self-compassion. So that meditation technique is really, really powerful. And it's so simple. May I be happy and well and safe. May I feel at ease. And it's that repetition. And if you remember right at the start of our conversation when I mentioned kindfulness, well, that practice is one of the practices that's been shown to cause physical changes in brain structure in those regions associated with positive mood, happiness and joy, and also compassion and empathy. But the compassion and empathy isn't just for other people. It's also for yourself. And it's like you've built that muscle in the brain that makes it easier. The more you practice it, the easier it becomes to access compassion and empathy for yourself. And it's not this kind of thing, like, I need to be critical of myself to make myself better. If you find that compassion and empathy, as I said, from that broader psychological state, you will probably better access the solutions that you're trying to find in a non-critical, more self-compassionate place.
I like it. I wanted to ask you just one last thing about kindness. I know we're coming to the end here, but that's lack of kindness. So, for example, many athletes are on social media there's been talk about press conferences and how that is difficult for some athletes, etc. The media, what's written about you. There's a feeling, of course, by the athlete, I would presume, of lack of kindness to them.
Yeah.
How does one deal with that? And, of course, will that have the effect or the opposite effect of what you're trying to espouse?
Yeah, I feel for them because I've seen some of that kind of stuff online and it's absolutely horrible and it's absolutely not necessary at all. And it really can be damaging to people's mental health. And it also can suck you in as well to having arguments with people. And that's when you start having arguments and justifying to people, that's when it becomes difficult for yourself as well. Self-compassion practices, like I've just talked about, they can be very powerful for yourself because what they do is they help you to stabilize your own self, your own psyche. It makes you feel like a stronger, more, almost like you have, you know, an inner strength. You know, and I say that inner strength, like I wrote a book about 7 years ago on the subject of self-esteem. And the reason I wrote the book on self-esteem isn't because I was an expert in self-esteem, but because I was chronically lacking in self-esteem. See, there's two types of self-esteem. There's external self-esteem, which many people in the world have. And it's when you derive your sense of worthiness and value from your successes and achievements and what other people think of you. And as long as all things are positive, you feel great on the inside. But that isn't healthy, external self-esteem, because all you need is the bad review or people's opinions to change and it's shattering. What we need is what's called internal self-esteem. And that's what you might define as an inner sense of your own worthiness and value. And that's not dependent upon successes and achievements in life. Neither is it dependent upon whether people like you or not. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't want to succeed and you don't want to achieve things and don't want people to like you. Of course you do. That's human nature. But it just means that if that kind of stuff happens, things change and you fail at something, you kind of feel genuinely strongly in the inside, you know what, I've got this. I'm okay. No matter what happens, I just know on the inside, I've got this inner warmth that I'm okay. And so those kind of self-compassion practices, self-gratitude, self-compassion practices, they can help to build that inner sense of warmth. Now, another thing, another tip I could actually share, a very practical tip, and this is something people could use today, right now, is when we're reacting to some of that stuff, what there is a link at all times between how a person feels, their emotional state, and the how you express that state physically on your body, whether it's overtly on your facial muscles. You have 43 facial muscles, many of which tense and contract when you feel stressed or worried, or you're reacting to something bad that someone said about you. And you wear it on your face. You don't realize we're doing it. It's like an unconscious reflex reaction on our neck, on our shoulders. We stop breathing, we tense. And the entire organism expresses on the outside physically what you're feeling on the inside. But here's the magic in this. The relationship between how you feel and the physical expression on your body is called bi-directional. And what that means is it's a two-way street. There's always a synchronization between how you feel and what your body's doing. It's why if you feel happy, you smile and it's automatic. You don't say, you know, I feel really happy today. Then what is I'm supposed to do with my face now? Oh, I smile. You don't remember. It's a reflex reaction. It's automatic because there's a synchronization. But if you do something, you know, many people have heard of laughter yoga. When you take a deep breath and you go, ha, 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 and you laugh. Yeah, it's like you fake it till you make it, but it's not the same as pretending that you're okay. There's a world of difference between laughing to pretend you're okay and laughing on purpose as an intervention. There's a world of difference. The latter is an intentional act which can actually make you feel better in the moment. So coming back to the reacting to people's, say, hate comments and stuff, when you read that kind of stuff, because of how you feel on the inside, you'll wear it on your face. Most people reading that will go, and the mouth will tense, the neck will tense, this corrugator supercilii muscle. It's called here, tenses up the neck, the jaw, the breathing, the heart rhythms begin to spike. A thing called heart rate variability, which should really be up and down like that, begins to waver about like that. It's a natural response as the nervous system feels stressed. But instead of doing that, the body reacts like that. If in the moment we read these comments, because there's a bi-directional relationship between how you feel and what the body's doing, and it goes both ways, in that moment, a simple technique is to straighten your back, lengthen your spine, straighten your spine, drop your shoulders, rub your face, massage all as many facial muscles as you can. Because what you're then doing is overloading the data that's coming from the brain saying, I feel shit or afraid or hurt at this moment, that's been worn on my face. So rub your facial muscles as many as you can for like 5 or 10 seconds like that. Lengthen your spine, drop your shoulders, and then breathe from your tummy. And what you'll find is now what your body's doing on the outside is beginning to inform how you're feeling on the inside. And it happens really, really fast. I mean, really quick. The reason it happens so quick is because language is relatively recent. I say relatively. Language is, what, 10, 15,000 years old, give or take a little bit. For eons of evolution, our ancient ancestors, before language, communicated through body language and gesture. So for eons, a link was formed between how one of our ancestors is feeling and how they expressed that on their face, and their intonations and their body, their shoulders, their back, everything. And so that link between the physical expression and the feeling became ingrained. And that's why today, when we use techniques like that, when we literally take control of what my body is doing, rather than reading that hate stuff and I'm unconsciously contracting and my body is showing it, I'm on purpose deciding to massage my face, lengthen my back, drop my shoulders and breathe. And because of that ancient wired relationship, very, very quickly you can change how you feel in the moment. And then you can be aware of the same thing, but it's not bugging you anymore. And either you'll be aware of the same hate and it doesn't bug you, or you'll just suddenly feel inspired to put it away. But either way, your state is now informed by what you're doing with your body on the outside. And it's a simple thing that all sports people can use, even on the court, on the pitch, whatever they're doing, because many times when we're feeling dejected, we drop our shoulders. And you get a negative spiral because you drop your shoulders or whatever similar body language. You use that body language because that's how you feel. But how you feel is then informing, but through that bi-directional relationship, what your body is now doing is reinforcing how you're feeling. And you get this spiral. And a simple thing to do again is stand up straight, wear it on your body, straighten your spine, drop your shoulders, and even physically move your body more slowly. Because when we're stressed, we move our bodies in a fast, jerky way. So slow it all down by actually moving your body, even artificially, more slowly with your shoulders dropped, spine erect, head up and breathing. And it's astonishing how quickly that physical state on the outside can change how you're feeling on the inside, whether you're doing it in a live sporting situation or whether you're doing that by just having read and digested 1,000 pieces of social media hate. Either way, the technique works because it's an ingrained, eons-long relation, eons-age-wired relationship between how you feel and the physical expression of that feeling.
Amazing. Really, really fascinating. David, thanks so much for some really insightful thoughts and tips and recommendations. Two short things just to wrap up. Firstly, I remember a while ago, I read this kindness challenge from you. Maybe you could give it to our audience. And then as a follow-up to that, where can our audience learn more from you about your books, your online courses, or your blog, or anything else?
Great. Oh, thanks, Alan. I have this thing I call the 7-day kindness challenge. And what it's really about doing is helping you to increase your experience of kindness and recognize not only things that you can do that are helpful to people and recognize the effect of that, but also notice how it makes you feel as well. And the challenge has 3 guidelines. And the first guideline is you have to do something different every day. So let's say you make someone a cup of tea today. You can make them a cup of tea tomorrow again, but it doesn't count because you've already counted it. So you've got 7 different things in 7 days. The second guideline is if you can, try to push yourself out your comfort zone at least once. So in other words, it might be easy to make wee cups of tea and do things that are in your comfort zone every day. And that's fair enough. But even if once you can do something that's a little bit of a stretch, you know, it's like when we're building our muscles, we want to put a wee bit of strain on them to increase the strength of them. So this is like a wee psychological exercise that can actually help to build your confidence and self-esteem in interacting, is just to find something that's possible for you, not something that's too difficult or wrong for you, but something that is within your capabilities. It's a wee stretch for you, a wee bit out of your comfort zone. The third thing is at least one of your acts of kindness has to be completely anonymous. So no one gets to know what you did. Or if people are aware of something that was done, no one gets to know that it was you, or at least for a period of time that's elapsed. So that's the three guidelines. Something different every day. If you can, push yourself out your comfort zone at least once. And the third one, one of your acts of kindness has to be completely anonymous. So that's the 7-day kindness challenge. You can start it right away if you like. The other question, where to find about me, my website is drdavidhamilton.com, and you can access all my, I write a blog every week. I've got like 200 or something on my website with links to scientific articles and stuff. A list of all my books are on my website as well, and links to all my social media channels. I put videos on every other day on lots of aspects of this kind of stuff, kindness as well, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube. I just put lots of content out all the time, but you can find most of it through links through my website anyway. And I have online courses as well on my website as well.
Well, I'll check it out, and I'll make sure I give you some kind reviews, of course. Listen, thank you very much, David.
Yeah, I've had such a great time chatting with you both. It's been really enjoyable.
We too, absolutely. It was really amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
Really awesome.
You really inspired me, David. Thank you so much. And yeah, we will be in touch for sure.
Do head over to the Thrive website. That's www.thrive, spelt THR, the digit one, VE.space, where you can sign up for further giveaways and, of course, tips. That's www.thrive, spelt THR1, VE.space. After all, this is your space to thrive.